I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's January 18th, and we have a lot to talk about. And we're going to jump right into some major news coming at the very end of last week from a research team at Harvard. The researchers published the results of a large study concluding that multiple sclerosis is caused or triggered by the Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV. By analyzing a series of blood samples from more than 10 million active-duty U.S. military service members between 1993 and 2013, the research team was able to determine that Epstein-Barr virus preceded both the symptoms of MS and any damage to the central nervous system. They were able to further determine that individuals who might be susceptible to MS, these are people whose genetic background, environment, or lifestyle increases their risk of MS, well, these individuals were 32 times more likely to develop MS once they had been exposed to the Epstein-Barr virus. The team at Harvard used a novel tool called VerScan to screen for evidence of an immune response to 200 other viruses, and they found no links between any other virus and the risk of MS. Something that we frequently talk about on the podcast is the potential viability of neurofilament light chain as a biomarker for MS. And just to review, a biomarker is a characteristic that can be objectively measured and evaluated as an indicator of normal or abnormal biological processes. For instance, if you go to your doctor because you're running a fever, your doctor might do a blood test. And if the results of the blood test indicate that your white cell count is high, your doctor will tell you that you have an infection. That high white cell count is a biomarker for infection. So, neurofilament light chain is a protein that's released into the spinal fluid and blood when there's axonal damage in the brain. And in this study, the research team found that in people who were Epstein-Barr virus negative at the beginning of the study, there was no indication of elevated neurofilament light chain until they were infected by EBV. After being infected by EBV, elevated levels of neurofilament light chain were detected prior to their MS diagnosis. That's further evidence that neurofilament light chain may indeed be a viable predictive biomarker for MS. We've talked a lot about the Epstein-Barr virus on previous podcast episodes. It's a very common virus, infecting somewhere around 90-95% of the U.S. population. It's the virus that causes mononucleosis, but the majority of people who are infected by the Epstein-Barr virus never develop mono. This is a virus that stays in your body for your entire lifetime, and there's no treatment that can eliminate the Epstein-Barr virus from a person's system. Now, back in January 2020, I attended the Pathways to Cures think tank hosted by the National MS Society. Attendees invited to participate in the think tank included some of the very best and brightest research scientists, rehabilitation specialists, and leaders from the National Institutes of Health. And they were joined by people affected by MS. Epstein-Barr virus was one of the topics discussed at this meeting, and I had an opportunity to sit down for a conversation with Dr. Cassandra Munger from the Harvard School of Public Health and one of the world's leading experts on Epstein-Barr virus. Dr. Munger is also a member of the research team whose study we've been discussing today. And in a moment, I'm going to share the conversation about MS and the Epstein-Barr virus that I had with Dr. Munger at the Pathways to Cures think tank in January 2020. I'm chatting with Dr. Cassandra Munger from the Harvard School of Public Health, and we're talking about the Epstein-Barr virus. You know, my wife received her MS diagnosis just over 20 years ago, and even then, the connection between the Epstein-Barr virus and MS was already a conversation. How has our understanding of that connection progressed? What do we know today about the connection between the Epstein-Barr virus and MS?
So we know a lot more today than we did 20 years ago about EBV, Epstein-Barr virus, and MS. Around 20 years ago, there were lots of different viruses that were being explored and considered in terms of their association with MS. And of those viruses, Epstein-Barr virus kept coming out as showing an association in ways that other viruses did not. So, for instance, when we look at levels of antibodies in people's blood, in people with MS, for example, they tend to have higher levels of antibodies towards Epstein-Barr virus than healthy people do, even though the vast majority of the population is infected with EBV. And so that was the first inclination that perhaps EBV was associated with MS. While other viruses have shown a signal, it hasn't been as strong as it has been and consistent as for EBV. And of course, looking at EBV in people with MS, we don't know if the EBV preceded the MS or if the high antibody levels preceded MS or if they're a consequence of the MS itself. So part of our research has been to try and look at EBV prior to a clinical onset of MS. And we've done that in several ways. We've looked at titer levels in healthy individuals, titers or antibody levels to EBV. We've looked at them in healthy individuals, for example, in our study in the U.S. military, where we have a few hundred cases of MS and some controls, and we're able to get blood samples that were collected on them prior to the development of their MS symptoms. And we can see already in that population and in others around the world where these similar studies have been done, that people who go on to develop MS have higher Epstein-Barr virus antibody levels in their blood than people who don't.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tell us that Epstein-Barr virus is one of the most common human viruses in the world, infecting somewhere around 90% of the population at some point in their lives. But 90% of the human population doesn't develop MS. Do we understand why?
Well, some populations, 100% of the population is infected with EBV. In the United States, it's a little bit lower, like you said, maybe 90, 95% of the population. But we don't understand, biologically what may be happening in those people with MS. It could be an interaction with genetics. There could be other risk factors, such as, maybe a low vitamin D level that's hitting at the same time that the virus infection is. It could be that there's another virus that is playing along with EBV in creating the conditions for MS to develop in those people. But we just don't know.
We're here at a Pathways to Cures think tank. Given that, how important do you think finding a way to prevent people from contracting EBV is to stopping or at least limiting multiple sclerosis?
So the collective epidemiology on the association between EBV and MS is a lot, is a great deal of evidence there. In addition to the studies that I mentioned earlier, we've also been able to look at people who are EBV negative to see when they seroconvert, and those among those who seroconvert who go on to develop MS. And we find that there is a very strong association between people who seroconvert to EBV and then develop MS in the next perhaps 3 to 5 years or so. So it suggests that EBV is causally related, that you need to have the EBV virus to get MS. In terms of prevention, when we use some of our epidemiological techniques, we can calculate things that we refer to as population attributable risks. And given the strength of the association with EBV and MS, and the fact that it is so prevalent, we've estimated that we could possibly prevent almost 90% of MS cases if we're able to remove EBV from the population. So being able to prevent EBV infection in a meaningful way, where a sterilizing immunity where people just don't become infected, would suggest that we could prevent many cases of MS from occurring.
I'm thinking about what I'll call a second step between someone being infected with the Epstein-Barr virus and developing MS, and that is that someone developing mononucleosis along the way. Can you talk a little bit about that step and how that changes the percentage in populations who develop MS once they've been infected by EBV and then gone on to develop mono.
So the vast majority of EBV infections occur early in childhood, and they're asymptomatic. They just occur without anyone even knowing that they've happened. However, in especially more developed countries such as the United States, many people escape EBV infection until they are an adolescent or a young adult. Typically, we see EBV infection rates go up around entry to college or entry to military service. And in about half of the individuals whose primary EBV infection is occurring at that late age will develop infectious mononucleosis. And what infectious mononucleosis is a very strong reaction to the EBV infection. And it is symptomatic. People with mono do have, fever and, that you're not well. And we have found that people with a history of infectious mononucleosis do have about a twofold increased risk of developing MS in the future. So there may be something about the timing of that infection, the reaction to the immune system's reaction to EBV in that moment that's predisposing them then to that increased risk of MS.
Well, while we're talking, there may not be much that anyone can do to avoid the Epstein-Barr virus today. But what can you tell me about other environmental factors that you've investigated that seem to increase the likelihood of MS and that are modifiable?
Right. So modifiable risk factors that we have identified include vitamin D levels, childhood obesity, adolescent obesity, and smoking. So I think that the epidemiological evidence to date does suggest that these could potentially be causally related to MS, and intervening on them could potentially reduce the population's risk of MS. So maintaining adequate vitamin D levels, either through supplement or responsible, judicious sun exposure, or preventing childhood obesity, adolescent obesity, and not smoking are huge for many diseases, not just MS. However, that may provide little comfort to people who already have MS who can't go back and modify those behaviors. But we also know that first-degree relatives of people with MS are at an increased risk. And helping your children maintain healthy body weight, helping your children maintain adequate vitamin D levels, encouraging them strongly to not pick up smoking could go a long way to reducing their risk for developing MS.
Thank you. That was my thinking, that if I was aware of a family history of MS, I would want to make sure the things that could be modified on behalf of my children were going to be modified to give them the best possible health outcome. And Dr. Munger, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you, John.
Again, that conversation took place in January 2020, and the research that Dr. Munger referred to was not the research that was just released a few days ago. I wanted to include the conversation because I thought Dr. Munger did such a masterful job of really breaking down the relationship between Epstein-Barr virus and multiple sclerosis. So what else do we still need to know? Well, we have to understand more about which conditions have to be present in order for the Epstein-Barr virus to trigger MS. We need to understand why some people are diagnosed with progressive forms of MS and others are diagnosed with the relapsing form of MS. For that matter, we need to know how or why MS progresses. And one thing that this study didn't address is whether the Epstein-Barr virus is involved in ongoing disease activity in people who already have MS. But there's work being done in that area as well. Regular listeners might remember that for each of the past 3 years, we've connected at the ECTRIMS conference with Dr. A.J. Joshi, the Chief Medical Officer at Atara Biotherapeutics. And our conversations have been about Atara's work on an experimental cell therapy called ATA-188. Now, this cell therapy is designed to eliminate Epstein-Barr virus from the infected immune cells in people living with MS. In a moment, we'll hear the conversation that I had with Dr. Joshi at the conclusion of this year's ECTRIMS meeting. This is the third ECTRIMS conference where I've had the opportunity to check in with Dr. A.J. Joshi, the Chief Medical Officer for Atara Biotherapeutics. And in each of our previous conversations, Dr. Joshi has given us an update on ATA-188, which is Atara Biotherapeutics' investigational cell therapy that's designed to attack B cells in the immune system that have been infected with the Epstein-Barr virus. There are many experts who believe that if you can eliminate the Epstein-Barr virus, you can eliminate most multiple sclerosis. And that's the theory behind ATA-188, that attacking the Epstein-Barr virus is a viable path to mitigating MS. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Joshi.
Great to be here, John. Thank you.
ATA-188 is described as an off-the-shelf allogenic T-cell immunotherapy. That's quite a mouthful. So I'm hoping you won't mind explaining what that actually means and how ATA-188 is designed to work.
Sure. So as you mentioned, John, I think the theory here behind ATA-188 is that Epstein-Barr virus is driving the process that leads to multiple sclerosis. And it does so by actually attacking and invading and infecting B cells. And these B cells then become infected by the Epstein-Barr virus, and then they essentially make their way to the brain over time. And then that's where they start that whole chronic immune cascade that really we believe is the cause of the demyelination that you see in multiple sclerosis. And of course, it's a demyelination then that leads to all of the symptoms that we all know. Now, what ATA-188 does is we're able to actually target very specifically just those B cells that are infected with Epstein-Barr virus. So ATA-188 is designed to use T cells, so healthy T cells from healthy donors who already have been exposed to Epstein-Barr virus. Remember, 95% of us have that. And it takes those T cells and we actually create a population of healthy T cells that are able to recognize Epstein-Barr virus. And we're able to actually freeze those T cells. So they're available really pretty much immediately for any patient who needs them. When we use the ATA-188 in our studies, we take the ATA-188, we administer to a patient. And at that point, the expectation is the T cells that make up ATA-188 go and find those EBV-infected B cells and eliminate them. And by eliminating them, you're actually, in theory, taking out the whole engine that's causing the inflammation, that's leading to demyelination, and that's leading to all of the MS symptomatology. So the thought process is what we may be doing here is going after a potential part of the root cause of MS by specifically attacking just those EBV-infected B cells.
This year, you're at ECTRIMS virtually sharing some really interesting news about ATA-188. Can you share that news with us?
Sure. You know, there's two really important pieces to this. One is our clinical data, and that really is focused in on this concept of disability improvement. So remember, in most multiple sclerosis studies, they're trying to show that the therapy that they're using is slowing the worsening of disability. Here, we're actually trying to show that we might even be able to turn the clock back and improve the disability. And in the past times that we've presented data for the program in an open label study, about 24 patient open label study, we've shown that in a group of patients, we are able to actually turn that clock back. Now, granted, this is phase one study, but it is important because we're showing disability improvement that you really don't see in other settings. And it's really not normal for a progressive MS patient to be able to kind of spontaneously see improvement like that. So we're seeing some really promising signs of efficacy there. Now, in the past, we've shown those data that go out to about 12 months. And then we've also shown data that says, you know, going past 12 months out into 18 months. Well, now we're showing data for all patients on our open label extension study that go out to at least 2 years. And in some settings, we have data all the way out to 33 and 39 months. So we've now been following people who've been treated with ATA-188 in the study, who've had disability improvement for that long time frame. And what we've seen is once they developed disability improvement at any point in the study, at every single consecutive time point, they maintain that disability improvement. So on average, we've seen that once you develop disability improvement, you've maintained it for at least 18 months. So a year and a half already, and we're going to continue to follow those patients. Now, there is one person in study that did have disability improvement and then developed a relapse as part of their treatment course and lost the disability improvement. But every other patient maintained it at every single time point. And now, as I said, on average, they're out to 18 months of full disability improvement. And we're going to continue to follow to see how much longer that keeps going. Another important part of the data are that the safety data, right? So we continue to see a really strong safety profile for the program. And, you know, with the additional data and with repeat treatments for patients, we haven't seen any new signals than what we've reported in the past.
Well, that's remarkable. Now, you said there were two pieces of news.
Oh, I forgot the second one. Thank you, John. Really important one, actually. You know, one of the questions we've gotten is, if you're seeing this disability improvement, what could actually be behind it? What's really causing the disability improvement? And what we presented now is a special MRI measure. It's called magnetization transfer ratio, MTR for short, and we'll just call it MTR because it's too tough to say the full name. But MTR is a specific MRI approach that in multiple sclerosis is generally connected to myelination or the amount of myelin that you have. So essentially, the way to look at it is if MTR goes down, that means you're losing myelin. If MTR goes up, that means you're gaining myelin. So in our study, we actually said, okay, let's take a look at the people who had disability improvement and compare their MTR to people who didn't have disability improvement. And what we found was that if you had disability improvement, there was actually a significant increase in your MTR. So meaning you had remyelination if you had EDSS improvement. So really for the first time, we're able to show a connection between myelination, so increasing your myelin to improvement in disability. So now you're coming up with, got it, there's a biological reason why we're having clinical improvement. You get basically HA-188 treatment led to remyelination in that setting. And then that remyelination is what was behind the disability improvement. So what's great is, I mean, we even achieved statistical significance on one of those parameters in a really small study. So obviously, small study, we need to generate more data in a randomized control setting. But to be able to show those kind of connections to what's causing the disability improvement is really powerful in such a small study at this time point.
Had you anticipated remyelination occurring?
As we were trying to think about why we could be seeing the clinical disability improvement, at that point, yes, we started saying, I wonder if there's remyelination there, because otherwise, how could you have people improving so much? You know, we've had people improving, for example, from, you know, an EDSS score of 5.5 all the way down to 3.0. And what could possibly explain that? So once we saw those results, we did start thinking about that possibility, but I will freely admit, when we first started the program in the earliest of days, that was not even in the thought process. So this is, you know, obviously it's a very, it's really pleasing to see the type of potential effect we may be able to have here. You know, obviously we want to be measured. We know there's more work to be done, but, you know, being able to produce information and data like this, it just keeps adding to our confidence that what we're seeing may really be a true benefit for patients.
Now, you're currently recruiting participants for a randomized, placebo-controlled phase 2 trial of ATA-188. Who can participate in the trial and how do they get involved?
We're recruiting for anyone who has SPMS or PPMS, so really either one. And specifically in this study, we're trying to focus in on non-active disease. So if you haven't had a flare in the last couple of years, that's what we're really focusing in on. So that way we can make sure that what we're looking at is disability change, right? So really anyone who's had kind of non-active disease for the last couple of years, SPMS, PPMS, males, females, as long as that disease has been non-active for the last couple of years. And again, that's, and you all know that it's really, as long as you haven't had a flare, that's someone who would really potentially be able to participate. The best way to discover how to participate would be to go to clinicaltrials.gov and look up ATA 188, and our study will jump right out. Another way to do it would be, you can certainly contact medical information at our company, Atara Bio, and we can also help you connect correctly to the appropriate study centers.
So again, that's anyone with secondary progressive or primary progressive MS who has not had an active flare for the past 2 years, right?
The people who are potentially eligible for the study, the main requirement is what I mentioned to you. There's, of course, other requirements. So there's some additional steps to participate. But the most important one is the one I mentioned about the no flares in the last 2 years. So I just want to make sure that everyone is aware of that.
Great. I wanted to repeat that because, very frankly, people who are living with progressive MS don't often get invited to this kind of a party. And I want to make sure they hear us, that not only is this work that just holds so much promise and it has been so encouraging all along, but it's work that is focused on a treatment, a therapy for progressive MS. What are the next steps for Atara Biotherapeutics? What happens next?
In terms of what's next, I think, you know, we have an exciting time frame. We're continuing to do a lot of additional work in the back end about the understanding what's happening with ATA 188. Obviously, the most important thing for us is the enrolling our phase 2 study. It's called the EMBOLD study. We're expecting actually to do an interim analysis of the study in the first half of next year. And at that point, we'll actually decide, do we want to expand it even more than we have now, or do we want to keep it the same size? And so that'll come in the first half of next year, but that's probably the next major important point and time frame for us related to this program.
Well, Dr. A.J. Joshi, once again, thanks for updating us on ATA 188. Thanks for talking with me today. I'm already looking forward to next year's update.
My pleasure, John, and thanks for having me.
Well, all of this news points to the obvious need for an Epstein-Barr virus vaccine. The research results announced by the investigators at Harvard certainly make the case that if we can eliminate the Epstein-Barr virus, we will effectively eliminate most MS. And work on developing the Epstein-Barr virus is already underway. Moderna is a pharmaceutical company that we've all come to be very familiar with through their work in developing the mRNA technology that's used in two of the COVID-19 vaccines that have proven to be both safe and effective. Well, just 2 weeks ago, Moderna dosed the very first participant in a phase 1 clinical trial for its mRNA Epstein-Barr virus vaccine. So while there's plenty of work ahead, plenty of questions yet to be answered, there's also some very encouraging news to share this week. And if you'd like to review the details of the Harvard study that created all of this excitement, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Over the past 228 episodes of Real Talk MS, I've gotten to know many of you, and many of you have heard my story and gotten to know me. But here's a fun fact that most of you don't know. Since childhood, I've performed magic. And for most of my adult life, my particular specialty has been sleight of hand, close-up magic. I'm even a member of the Magic Castle, a world-famous private club for magicians in Hollywood. Now, I don't try to keep any of this a secret, but since we talk about things related to MS, it's just never come up on the podcast. So let me tell you why I'm talking about it today. In about 2.5 weeks, the National MS Society is hosting a live-streamed event called MS Got Talent, and I'll be doing some magic as part of the program. It's going to be a really fun show with some amazing performances by people in the MS community, and I hope you can join us. MS Got Talent is going to be live-streamed at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, January 29th, and you'll be able to view the show live by visiting twitch.tv slash MS Society, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. So if you're free on January 29th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, that's 4 p.m. Pacific Time, I hope you'll join me for what sounds like a lot of fun. And I'm planning to do something that I can guarantee you've never seen before. Don't forget to check today's show notes for that link. That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/229. You'll find that link in today's show notes so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. And I hope you make a note to join me on Saturday, January 29th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time for MS Got Talent. You'll see some great performances. It's going to be a lot of fun, and you'll find a link for the live stream in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.